Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, I'm Nick Mullins, and welcome along to this week's Rugby Tonight podcast. We are in southwest London this week at Richmond Rugby Club, to be precise, the old athletic ground, and Lord Lorenzo of London is with us. How are you doing, Lord?
I'm very well, thank you, Nick.
This place brings back some memories for you, I'd imagine. You were getting yourself muddy out on that pitch behind us?
Yes, I was. I sort of grew up in West London, so Richmond has never been too far away. I played here as a young boy, and I mean a really young boy, age sort of eight, mini rugby as it was in those days, and things went on from there. I couldn't stay at Richmond. I went off to North Yorkshire because my parents didn't like me that much and decided that...
You got banished. The moors.
The bright lights of London were turning me in the wrong direction. So, I was sent up to North Yorkshire to learn what real weather was like. But no, I've got very fond memories of Richmond. I still keep a very close eye on them in the Championship, as they now are. They obviously reached the heady heights of the Premiership at one time. I was tapped up, if you could say that, to come and play here at Richmond.
I was going to talk to you about that, because was it Ashley Levett back in the days when, and lots of people will remember those days in the mid-90s, early days of professionalism, and they very nearly won the Premier League, didn't they? Yeah. With Brian Moore, Ben Clark, the Quinnells, Alan Bateman, P-Shot, Barry Williams, the Lions Hooker, the great and the good. Came here following Ashley Levett's.
They did. I mean, it was the Richmond Revolution, if you like, and led by the wonderful Ben Clark. And as you say, some big, big names, you know, P-Shot and Brian Moore and the Quinnell brothers. But I kind of looked at Richmond and thought, perhaps with the Quinnell brothers and Ben Clark, they had enough good quality back row forwards already.
They didn't offer you enough money. Come on.
They did.
They offered you a lot.
I felt that, one, that Wasps were on the rise, and secondly, that... if I was at the end of my career, like Ben Clark, then I would have taken that opportunity with open arms. But I was very much feeling that if you wanted to play for England in those days, you normally had to be playing at one or two or three clubs, and Bath, Leicester or Wasps, really. Nowadays, it's much more democratic. You can be playing for anyone and inside England and still get picked. But I think in those days, you were very clear about the quality of rugby you needed.
Don't get many one-club men these days. I guess the advent of cash means that people travel around and pay off mortgages. But when were you closest to leaving Wasps?
I think inevitably, there's normally a lot of reasons why you're at one club. One is financial. Two is around family. It was never always a decision for myself. It was always a decision for a few other people as well, because I had young children at a very young age while I was, 23, 24. So, what I used to say to players who were thinking about leaving the club is that what you have to remember is that rugby is only 80 minutes every weekend. The rest of the time you have to live there. Now, if you're comfortable living at that rugby club, then that's up to you. But a lot of people move for one reason, which is financial, or it might be, to further their chances. And I think you've got to look at it in the full spectrum. It's about where you want to live. Where do your family want to live? It might be about schools. It might be about the quality of rugby. It might be about your teammates.
So you never thought of leaving? You were never close
to leaving?
I did.
I did think once about leaving.
To who?
It really was probably down to the West Country, because my wife was quite keen on. She said to me, don't even think about Newcastle. I said, okay.
Leicester? Leicester's a nice place.
Leicester, social immobility were the two words she said to me. I said, thank you. Okay. these were her words, not mine, yeah. of course. So I think the West Country was probably...
That's a nice place at any time.
And also, I mean, my wife's from Devon. Bath yeah. were, you know, a famous club at that time. Unfortunately, Bath did make me an offer, but they sort of offered me less than I was being paid, which is not really... I mean,
not
even in my even in my sort of basic economics,
no.
it's not really how it works, is it really? So, sorry, I'm going to come join your club and you want me to earn less than I'm earning now.
Mm. We'll get on to... we'll talk about Joe Launchbury a little bit later because he, a bit like you, has decided to stick with the club that he grew up with. He signed a new contract with Wasps this week. We won't talk about that now. But being here does bring back memories of the old days. And there was a lovely piece in The Guardian this week by Rob Kitson, one or two of you may have seen it, about how Richmond, having gone all the way down the English ladder and making their way back up, and they're back in the Championship now, Lol, as you say, and they're doing really well. I think they've won half a dozen games, beating big sides. But they're amateur. They're training on Tuesdays and Wednesdays, and they're doing it for a bit of fun, just like the old days.
Yeah, I mean, they're currently sixth out of 13 clubs in the Championship. And other than Bristol, whose obviously total wage bill is probably significant and somewhere closer to where most of the Premiership clubs are, a lot of the Championship clubs, like Richmond, are either semi-professional or totally amateur. So, and what we mean by amateur is that they train on a Tuesday and a Thursday night only, and they play on Saturday. And it's great to see that, you know, them existing and going toe-to-toe with sides that probably are spending more time training. And that sort of throws up the question around, you know, the boredom of certain rugby players. And, you know, the life of a professional rugby player is not necessarily as glamorous as one might imagine. And actually, talking to the coaches here, what's really impressed them is that because they only train twice a week, you know, they can't wait to get here and they're really excited about training, you know, and they absolutely love it. So they're sort of sponges for information. And they're very fortunate because of the location to have some wonderful sort of expertise that drops in. George Robson is currently running the line-out sessions. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Adam Jones, the great Welsh and Harlequins prop, is currently running scrummaging. So yep. they are, for all intents and purposes, they might only train twice a week, but I think they would say it's quality rather than
quantity. Did you do a bit as well?
Quantity. I did a little bit here, and I found it quite interesting because, you know, some days you'd have a full squad, and then other days, you know, someone had a wedding or a stag trip that weekend. Sorry,
recovering from a hangover.
I can't play on Saturday because I'm not here. So, you know, that's the kind of frustrations as an amateur that you have to get used to, you know, when you're coaching those sorts of players. But on the flip side of that, you know, it's brilliant to see them doing so well. And I think they found their level because a lot of people widely expect them to get, you know, relegated straight back down to the league they came from.
Good firework displays here as well. Last time I was here, wasn't commentating, it was a firework display. They do a good firework display. It's great to see Richmond back, and it's lovely to be back here in the boardroom. And Lol, not surprisingly, has taken the chief executive spot. I am the secretary tonight. So much to look forward to over the next half an hour or so. It's the return of Europe this weekend, fortnight, the double header where people play each other home and away. Munster, Leicester, one of our big games. We've got some real crackers this weekend. We'll look ahead to those over the next few minutes. We'll hear from Peter O'Mahony, by the way. He's had a lot to say for himself this week. Some chat about his future, where he might be playing, whether he's going to be staying in Limerick over the next few seasons. We will hear from him. We'll go through all the fixtures and whet your appetite for the Champions Cup, Challenge Cup to come. But let's start with what we saw domestically, Lol, this weekend in the Aviva Premiership. You and I were travelling around together. We went to Sandy Park on the Saturday, got the train back to Paddington at the Stoop on the Sunday. And it wasn't just our games. It seemed that maybe not so much Northampton-Newcastle on the Friday night, which was a slow burner, but there's so much good stuff going on in the Premiership at the moment. It's a good watch, isn't it? Good entertainment.
It's absolutely fantastic. And I'm not sure whether it's because we're kind of nearly at the halfway point or whether it's because we've... You know, absence makes the heart grow fonder, doesn't it, really? We've had 3 weeks of international rugby, which is great, and we all love international rugby, but it's not the Premiership, it's different. And I think suddenly to be back, you know, in the Aviva Premiership, to have all those international players back and to, you know, almost feels like the intensity suddenly lifted. And as you approach Christmas, there's something very special about the Premiership. You know, I mean, I've been playing and watching Aviva Premiership Rugby for as long as I care to remember, but I still get as excited about games and venues and stadiums, and when you look at the team sheets and you think, this is going to be an absolute cracker today. And this weekend particularly, you know, we were not disappointed with some of those games going down to the absolute last play of the game.
Three of the six games weren't decided until the last play of the match. The Stoop,
yep.
Gardens on the Friday night, and the Rico Wasps against Leicester. And we had that late flourish from Bath as well. Didn't change the outcome of the match, but Bath picking up a losing bonus point late on at Sandy Park.
And I think what we're seeing this season in the Aviva Premiership is a concertina. Yes, Exeter are champions. Yes, Saracens are European champions. And, you know, and everyone's already, you know, at the beginning of the season, making their predictions about the top four based on what they saw last season. But you've got to say that, you know, I think the points differential between, say, third and or even second and the kind of team in 10th is one win or two wins. So I think we're seeing a much closer
competition.
I think the improvement of clubs of certain sides.
The salary cap is starting to even out, starting
to bite those clubs at the top who cannot retain all their most successful players year on year. I think each and every side has one or two players in their squad that is capable of winning games on their own. And I think we saw that at the weekend. You know, the return of Cipriani for Wasps, the piece of skill from Danny Kerr. You know, on any given Saturday or Sunday, if you're not quite at your very best, whether you're Saracens or whoever it is, you will get beaten. And that's what makes it very exciting, I guess.
Do you know the other thing that struck me, and it was kind of amplified by Gloucester's decision this week not to put down an artificial pitch at Kingsholm next season, but to go for one of those hybrids that have proved so successful up the road at Twickenham. I think they're using the company that did the one at Croke Park, Ellis Park. The thing that struck me is that if we'd have been watching you here at the Athletic Ground in Richmond 20 years ago, you'd have been disappearing beneath 6 feet of mud at around this time of year. But the pitches, even in December, look as good as they did at the start of the season.
Yeah, and I talked to a lot of the Premiership players up and down the country on our travels, and that's the one thing that really comes that stands out. Is I said, what's the big difference now? And they said, well, just the quality, not just of the training pitches in and around the facilities of the club, but also the playing surfaces around the country. As you said, Gloucester at Kingsholm particularly, probably being one of the worst that I used to play on, particularly when we had a heavy, you know, rainfall in the winter. They used to train on that pitch as well, so you can imagine it made it even worse. They almost used to thrive on the fact that it was a bit of a paddy field. Leicester, you know, Welford Road was renowned for having wonderful stands, but the actual important bit in the middle was awful. But now, you know, all the clubs have invested wonderfully, and you know, they're almost like bowling greens now. And I mean, we have to remember that the weather is variable in the UK. Sometimes we'd like to play three and four games a day on the same pitch. I remember going to Australia when I was a young kid. You know, they'd start with the under 16 fixture, then the under 18, and the whole thing would build up women's rugby, and the whole thing would leverage up to the first team game at the end. You know, of course, in Australia that's easy. It would be wonderful if we could do that, and that's probably why the argument for a 4G pitch is there, because it means the whole club can enjoy the facilities,
and it works beautifully. For Saracens, you go along to Allianz Park on a game day and they've got the minis out there beforehand. Everyone's invited onto the pitch afterwards. The same at Kingston Park as well in Newcastle. They have rugby league games on the pitch around the games now. We absolutely get what 4G does. But I thought that Gloucester's decision was interesting, because I'd heard a couple of years ago that they were absolutely going to go for a plastic pitch. And I thought, this is going to be really interesting to have a 4G pitch at Kingsholm. That really is throwing out the crown jewels. But they spoke to the players, and the players have said, no, we'd rather have a hybrid.
Yeah, and that's reassuring and pleasing to see. I think a lot of the reasons for clubs wanting to go to 4G is non-rugby related. It's around the commercial side of the business. How can they bring more revenue into the club? Well, they've got to use their asset, which is the pitch. But also, there's something very traditional about having grass, and the game is becoming quite sanitized in lots of different ways, and I think keeping the pitch grass and traditional for me is an absolute must. You know, we will always have one or two pitches that, like Saracens, like Six Ways, Newcastle, but I think a third of the league is more than enough.
We're going to go on. We'll start by having a look back on actually what was the final game of the weekend up the road at the Stoop in a moment or two. But you touched on there the fact that clubs can now play a couple of games on a match day. Mm. And there was a wonderful to see after the Saracens' trip to the Stoop on Sunday, the two clubs' women's teams played a game in the Tyrrell Premier 15s, yeah, and thousands stayed on. And it just struck me that if we're going to grow the women's game, you might not be able to do it every weekend, but these double headers work so well to put something on for those who are already in the ground.
Absolutely. And look, the quality of the rugby on display was also there. I mean, the women's game has come on no end in the last 5-10 years, to the point where they've actually, you know, become world champions and didn't quite make it again this time around. But you know, as I said, the way the women's game has grown, they've earned the right to play out on those pitches, and why shouldn't they? I mean, the advent of this, you know, new Tyrrell's League is brilliant. Certainly all the clubs are trying to embrace it with everything they have, and you know, people will vote with their feet, and quite clearly, you know, all those fans who stay behind, you know, got to see a wonderful game of rugby.
They did. I mean, some of the hits were just, yeah. I was watching it with a guy called Matthew Pearce, who you might know as the South African
Absolutely.
Commentator in the Rugby Championship. And me and Matt were watching it from the press box, and he was going, "Oh my God!" I mean, it was as brutal as the Quins Saracens game had been before, and with people like Marley Packer flying around. Around the breakdowns, it was just a
Well, I think for those of us who've I mean, I've been lucky enough to be invited to help with some of the coaching for some of the women's rugby teams and the women's players, particularly the England squad, and the work ethic. You know, I've said this all along. You know, if their counterparts in the men's team had the same level of work ethic as they did, you know, they'd have been world champions two or three times over.
And we have daughters, Lawrence, teenage daughters, who look at, I mean, they go along to a game of rugby, and at the end of it, they're not heading home. They're looking at somebody like Marley Packer or Vicky Cornborough or Rachel Burford.
Well, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's so important for young girls to have those same role models, and why should they not be in rugby as well? So, no, I'm all for it. I think the game is moving on. There was a moment in time last year where the RFU were sort of throwing money into the seven-a-side, you know, game, and but actually now it looks like they're firmly behind, you know, women's 15-a-side rugby. So watch this space.
What about that game that we saw before the women's game? Saracens losing almost unbelievably a fifth in a row. Two of those have been in the Anglo-Welsh, but five in a row now. What's happening with Saras right now?
Well, I mean, I sort of discount the Anglo-Welsh. I know I shouldn't because it's all part of the same statistics, but it is a very different squad. So, you know, if you take those to one side, they've lost three premiership matches in a row, which is very unlike Saracens. In fact, I think it's unprecedented for quite some time. Even more worrying for them is that they've won it. They've lost those games from a position where they were winning. So in all three of those games against, you know, Gloucester, against Exeter, and then most recently against Harlequins, they've been ahead at half time, and then they've gone on to lose the game. So, and this one particularly will cause more alarm bells than anything, because it, you know, myself included, I felt that the return of the likes of Farrell and Itoje and Jamie George would just have a little bit too much in the locker to beat Saracens, to beat Harlequins. So, yeah, it is a concern, and they are going through a bit of a spell at the moment where, you know, I'm sure that they're looking, you know, long and hard. And what's been interesting is that, you know, Harlequins came up with a game plan to try and take on Saracens, and it unsettled them a bit. Exeter came up with a slightly different game plan about patience and holding on to the ball and going through the phases, and that really unsettled Saracens. And it just shows, you know, particularly at the Stoop, if you haven't got the ball, you can't win the game. And Quins, you know, just spent so many minutes with the ball and putting Saracens under serious pressure. So, you know, Mark McCall and his coaches have got a bit of homework and a bit of thinking to do.
Shouldn't forget Quins. I mean, they were magnificent.
They were magnificent.
And actually, one of the highlights of our afternoon was chatting with Alex Sanderson mid-match when he said Harlequins when they, I won't bother with the accent, Harlequins when they play us grow baubles.
Well, they seem to grow a pair, I think.
That's what he was saying.
He said, and you know, none of us should have been surprised by the result, but we were, because
that's the third time at the Stoop that Quins have been
in a row, and you know, clearly Harlequins are the team that can rise to the big occasion. You know, they've gone away to Wasps and they've won. They got under Wasp skin and they really set out with a game plan, particularly when they lost Marcus Smith, you know, before the kickoff. James Lang stepped in. I thought that they're real experienced players who if I'm honest, have never always stepped up to the plate when they've come back from international duty. And I'm talking about the likes of Mike Brown, Chris Robshaw, who was outstanding.
We talked a lot about Robshaw during the game, didn't we? I mean, let's talk actually about Chris, because you'll have been in situations during your England career when you'd been written off. And the experts in the media were saying you were no longer worth your place in the squad. Fans were saying that. What Robshaw has done to get himself back into the position that he's in now?
Well, I think he's worked incredibly hard. There's no doubt about that. And whatever any player tells you, as you get a little bit older, you have to work a bit harder to get the same results or to get better results. I think he's used the kind of criticism, rightly or wrongly, he's used it to fuel his own motivation and set himself his own personal targets. He seems to be a player who is, you know, settled down with his own personal situation. And I think that, you know, happy wife, happy life, that always generally helps as well. You take that kind of feeling out onto the rugby field and you're much more content in your own skin. And, you know, not having the pressure, the added pressure of the captaincy, but yet playing almost like England's spiritual leader, because, you know, he's still very, very vocal out on the field. He's still got the respect of the team, the players. He hasn't got the armband, but, you know, I call him England's spiritual leader because, you know, it's great to have a guy out there on the field who's been captain, but who's not currently captain, because he doesn't lose that experience just because he's not got the armband. So not only are England benefiting from that, he's almost, outside of Owen Farrell, the next name on England's team sheet. And Harlequins now are starting to benefit from that too.
Yeah, I really enjoyed watching Ronaldo Bothmer as well. I know he was one of the players that John Kingston was really excited about at the start of the season. They've not had him because of injuries, but he just brought a bit of grit and,
yeah, and I think
hard grade sandpaper to the back row.
He really did. And you know, Harlequins haven't, because they've got so many quality players that for England, they haven't really got the sort of stellar signings that some of these other clubs have. And maybe Bothmer is not one that stood out to anyone, but he, you know, if he does half the job that Jack Berger did for Saracens, he's going to be a really popular amongst the faithful. And what I was so impressed with Harlequins is that in order to beat Saracens, you've got to take them on up front. And you've got to take on some very talented, very good quality players. And they almost developed a game plan that made sure that their forwards absolutely had to take that game to Saracens. And they caused them no end of problems.
We saw Mauro Itoje go off. I think, if we're being frank, we didn't realise at the time it was quite such a serious injury, because we just assumed it was a nasty blow to the mouth and there was some blood coming out. We assumed it was just going to be a bloodbath injury. But actually, he's fractured his jaw and he's gone. Mark McCall telling us this week that he's gone for either 3 to 4 weeks, depending on how successful the operation is, or perhaps more likely, 2 to 3 months, which clearly has big implications for Saracens, big implications for England and the way Eddie Jones might have thought about setting up his team for the Six Nations.
Yeah, it's a disappointment for him. And if we're honest, he's a player that's star has continued to rise and rise and rise. He can still count on probably two hands now the number of games he's lost, but it's not many. He's achieved so much in a short space of time. Other than a sort of a 4 or 5 week hand injury, he's not really had any setbacks. So it's going to be an interesting personal challenge for him. As you say, it was friendly fire. He wasn't actually hit by his own teammate, shoulder in the mouth. And we probably should have known at the time that most rugby players, if they go off for blood, they tend to come back on again. So the fact he didn't actually come back on, he fractured his jaw in two places. So he's had two plates put in his mouth. You know, that to me, I never fractured my jaw, but I was close to people who did. You know, that to me sounds like it's an 8 week recovery time, you know, at best. The Six Nations is 9 weeks away, I think, or 8.5 weeks away from the Italy game. So, you know, it's a concern, not just for England, but for Saracens. And I guess the irony is that here's a player who was removed from the fray to try and manage his game time because he's worked very hard for the Lions and for England. And the minute he returns back to the fray, he picks up an innocuous but very serious mouth injury. So, you know, it's a personal time for him to, you know, and it's probably the first time that he will, you know, genuinely have to sort of contemplate, you know, what things that he might do while he's recovering. I guess the only consolation is that once the injury has settled down, he'll be able to sort of carry on the running and the fitness-based training that he needs to keep going.
Did you sense that Eddie was going to play him in the second row or the back row for the Six Nations?
I mean, personally, I still think the second row is his best position.
Yeah.
I mean, Eddie is now sort of looking at getting his best players out on the field, and because of the quality of Law's performances this season, Courtney Law's, and the quality of Joe Launchbury and Itoje, he's got, you know, and not forgetting even a player of George Cruz's quality, let alone the others, he wants to get as many of those guys out on the field. So he probably would have, you know, used him in the second row and the back row, I think.
Yeah.
But I still think his best position is in the second row.
We're unofficially going to call this bit of the podcast the injury bit, because as much as we'll talk about Wasps, Leicester in a sec, let's touch on Ellis Genge as well. Because it seemed pretty innocuous when he went off just before half-time at the Rico, but he's done his shoulder. He's had an operation this week, and he's gone for at least a couple of months, so that might be his Six Nations as well.
Yeah, it's very disappointing because, we've obviously got Mako Vunipola and Joe Marler as those two kind of established players, but Ellis Genge was really coming through, you know, taken to Argentina, played in the autumn in that last game, looking really strong, has been going really well for Leicester Tigers, and, you know, it's just so unfortunate for him personally and for everyone involved, the club and England, because, shoulder injuries are nasty. And the fact that he was removed from the European squad for Leicester Tigers suggests that, you know, this could be a long-term injury, 2 months, possibly longer. So, we wish him all the very best. And I guess it opens up another opportunity for Eddie Jones to look at other players.
Yep. Brilliant win for Newcastle to start the weekend up at the Gardens, Nilialatu's late try. What of Northampton? If you're a Northampton player this week, and they're in a bit of a hole now, and we've talked a lot about the coaches, but as a player, what kind of responsibility are you taking? You were in this position not so long ago.
Yeah, I mean, Dylan Hartley, the England captain and the Northampton captain this season, has come out and said, yes, we are in a hole. It's a tough one. It's that they've been a funny old club, because they came out and had suffered that horrible opening day defeat against Saracens. Then they steadied the ship. They're in the top four, and then suddenly they've gone on a run where they've lost five in a row, and they're at the wrong end of the table for Northampton. And they still lose a lot of players to international duty, not least the England captain and one or two others. I do feel though that the players that get left behind need to absorb a bit more of that responsibility and run the club. Two schools of thought here. You either change your players on a more regular basis than Northampton are doing, or you change your coaching staff. The average tenure of directors of rugby tends to be around about 3 or 4 or 5 years. Jim Mallinder and co have been there a lot longer than that. I mean, you probably know exactly how long, but
they're the longest serving now. Yeah.
So when you're there as a director of rugby, you're continually trying to reinvent your message to the same group of players.
Yeah.
And that message kind of runs a bit thin. So you've either got to change your players or you've got to change yourself. And from what I can see, they haven't changed their players. So the same message is landing on the same players, door, and that message is not getting through. So, I'm not suggesting Jim has to leave that, but something has to change there. And you either move your players on or you move on. And it's getting to that point. If I was a Northampton Saints fan, where I'd be asking some quite serious questions around which of those two is it going to be. I'm not doubting Jim Mallinder's ability to communicate that message, but if he's communicating it to the same people week in, week out, and it's now not starting to hit, then something has to be done.
We were at Sandy Park on Saturday night watching the Chiefs.
Amazing.
Against Bath. And again, in hindsight, maybe we didn't wrap it up in the ribbons and bows that first 60 minutes ought to have been wrapped up in, because certainly on Twitter, Chiefs fans who see them week in, week out, year in, year out, were suggesting that that's the best 60 minutes they've seen from Chiefs for as long as they can remember.
Yeah, I would 100% agree with that. The edge was possibly taken off it by the fact that Bath, who were not in the game in any way, shape or form for that first 60 minutes, ended up scoring somehow four tries. Two things that stand out for me from Exeter. They are the champions of England. That is not a mantle that's always been worn very comfortably with sides. You know, the Premiership is so tough. The team that have won the title 1 year have found it quite difficult to continually win it. In fact, I think it keeps changing hands every year. So that tells you how difficult it is. I remember my own experience of being champions. You know, yes, we won the Premiership 3 years in a row, but it's really hard to go and do that same thing again and again. So the way Exeter have approached that, no hangover from last season, they started off, they've got better, they've built on that. And that, you know, and secondly, the quality of that squad, which was highlighted by the performance that we saw over that first 55 minutes, the fact that they're on 55 minutes, they're playing another side who are in the top four, and they're able to take off, arguably, Luke Cowan-Dickey, you know, who's a quality player. They were able to take off Thomas Waldron. They were able to substitute all these players and bring on, you know, bring on England's number eight, Sam Simmons. You know, just the quality that they had in their squad tells me that this is a side that are not just going to be competing at the top of the English table, but actually now have got a squad that are going to go on and be comfortable challenging at the European top table.
Yep, they are. They're the ones to chase at the moment. Crikey, they're some distance better than the bulk of the Premiership right now, that's for sure. What about Wasps, Leicester? It was just great entertainment, and when the clock stopped, Wasps were ahead. It was just one of those games, wasn't it?
Really? It was, and I think, you know, going back to our Exeter conversation, conversely, Wasps have had a bit of a hangover at the beginning of this season. They got to the Premiership final. They played mightily well all season. They were 80 seconds away from becoming champions of England, so you could argue that that could have gone either way as well. But they've suffered a bit of a hangover. I think their players just thought that it was all going to happen again, and they've had to recalibrate themselves. And it's taken probably 4 or 5 weeks into the season, and they've suddenly woken up and thought, hey, well, chaps, we're at the wrong end of the table here. This is not good enough. And, you know, yes, they've had a number of injuries that they didn't have last season, and they've had to manage their squad.
Cipriani being key really disrupted the balance of that back line.
So much goes through him. In fact, everything goes through him. That, you know, his return to injury 3 or 4 weeks ahead of schedule is a testament to himself. But actually, it's not just his return. It's what he did when he came back. The signs when he came on against London Irish were very positive. They won that game. He produced, you know, a moment of magic at the end of the game, which won Wasps the game, quite simply. So, you know, delighted to see. And the good news for Wasps fans, you know, they've still got a long way to go to sort of reassure everyone that they're going to be contending again for the title. But the good news is that they're probably, in patches against the Tigers, played some of the best rugby that we've seen from them all season. Because even though Leicester scored 3 tries, Wasps in defence were magnificent as well. And I think they probably just about deserve to win because of their execution.
We ought to mention Phil Blake, actually, because yeah. He left Leicester under a little bit of a minor cloud. But has really started, it seems, to make an impact on the quality of Wasps bolts in that defence.
Yeah, they're the great entertainers, Wasps, aren't they? They set the Premiership, you know, try scoring records last season. They were just magnificent to watch, very, very easy on the eye, and they still are at their very best. Some of those tries they scored last week against the Tigers were magnificent. But defence wins championships, as I can hear Sean Edwards talking in my ear now. You know, if you don't lose a try, you don't lose a game. You know, that's generally the rule. So, and one would argue that the way Wasps were defending last season, they certainly weren't going to win anything. So, you know, Phil Blake has stemmed the flow, and I'm sure that's something they're going to continue to build on going forward.
Not seen much of Nizam Carr, but he looks all right, doesn't he?
I like the name as well, Nizam Carr.
I didn't know how to spell it. I had to get the club to tell me how to spell it. But that's the kind of player he was. You know, he wasn't. They weren't bringing in a Skolt Berger. They weren't bringing in a bloke that we'd all heard of.
Well, Dai Young has sort of shown over the last few years what a shrewd eye he has for signing players. This was kind of forced on him, really. He had to dip into the market because of the injuries that they had right across the back row, of course. Alex Reader going out with a dislocated elbow or shoulder and a number of other high-profile injuries. And he's done a stupid bit of business there because, for whatever reason, you know, the South Africans are sort of settling very nicely in Coventry, aren't they? You've got, obviously, Willy LaRue, you know, Ashley Johnson. Juan de Jong. And, you know, Nizam Carr now is there. And from what I've seen of him, and it's not been a huge amount, but his performances in the last 4 games just suggest that Dai might be opening up the conversation to keep him there that little bit longer.
Saw this week that Gloucester have renewed contracts with Tim Taylor and Johnny Bell. attack coach and defence coach, respectively. And we've talked an awful lot about what Johan Ackerman has brought to Gloucester. They're second this week. You look at the Aviva Premiership table today, they're second. How long can this go on for? What is a realistic ambition as a finishing position this season?
Well, they've been the sort of constant frustration, for a lot of people, Gloucester, because the opening game of the season, they beat the champions, Exeter. Yeah, admittedly, with the last play of the game, or it was a dramatic finish, but they beat the champions. And then you kind of thought, well, is this the year where Gloucester are going to, stand up and be counted? And then they suddenly lose games that they should really be winning. What they've done now is they've gone on a run where they've won five games on the spin. Gloucester were always a side that could win at home and never win away. I've been so impressed with the way that they've gone about their work. And it seems to be that they've looked back at turn to youth to really, add that injection of enthusiasm. I've never sort of thought long and hard about going into coaching. But if I did, I could tell you that if I didn't coach the club that I played for, was for 20 years, the one club that has always stuck out in my mind has been Gloucester, because it's a wonderful rugby club, that they have 19,000 passionate fans who turn up every other week, that spoon-feed their team adrenaline. It would not be that difficult to get them rocking. And exactly what Ackerman's done. He's focused on the basics and he has them playing really, really well. And, they're a giant of English rugby. They're a giant that deserves a lot more than what they've delivered over the last few years. So, and they're shaking it up. They're shaking it up. They're at the top end of the table. And if they continue to play the way that they're playing, winning games at home and making King's Home the fortress that it was when I used to play there, difficult place to go and play, and they can pick up the odd win or a few points on the road, they'll be in the shake-up.
I was talking to Lewis Ludlow a couple of weeks ago about the quality of that defence, and he said, and Billy Burns as well, interestingly, as a fly half who lets to roll up his sleeves as well. And I think they're all thinking, maybe for the first time, maybe not within the last couple of weeks, but it's certainly been something that Johnny Bell's brought in, that defending can be fun, a bit like it was with Saracens and Paul Gustard and is now with England, that actually throwing the ball around and running them in from 50 metres puts a smile on your face, but you've got to win the ball back. So let's turn that process of winning the ball back, the defence, into something you enjoy just as much as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And Lewis Ludlow, by the way, has been one of the standout players in these opening 10 rounds of the season. I mean, he's been absolutely magnificent.
He was on my show. We have to draw up a shortlist of three for Premiership Player of the Month, and he was on my shortlist.
And when you find your team at the top of the table, there'll be a number of players who have suddenly hit a rich vein of form, him being one of them. And as you said, it's not just about scoring tries, it's about stopping them. And they look like they've really got the bit between the teeth. And the fact that I think the statement was really when they beat Saracens down at King's Home, and the confidence that you could see as they've suddenly gleaned from that. Actually, we can play and beat the very best sides in the world. Yes, they're missing a few players, admittedly, but it's still Saracens, it's still the European champions, and we've beaten them. So the confidence is oozing through the system there, and it's good to see because, they're a side that everyone likes to see at the top of the table. Yeah.
Another defeat for Irish. It's not getting any easier for them. It didn't get that much harder, though, because Worcester, who I actually had down as home winners in the BT Sport Predictor League, which is a mugs game, by the way.
As did I.
Anybody who thinks that predicting the results in the Aviva Premiership is easy this season, have a go at the BT Sport Predictor League. I thought Worcester were nailed on to beat Sale, which shows what we all know.
Well, I think with the predicting results in the Aviva Premiership, out of six games that are played across the weekend, you've got to pick two that defy logic. And what we did was we went captain sensible and we tried to not do that. And we thought, well, we'll just go with the percentage play. Worcester are going to win. They've just beat Leicester the week before. And therefore, Sale, a bit ropey on the road, they've got to win this game. But it's just amazing how it turns out. And it's going to, people are saying, is it going to be a straight scrap between Worcester and London Irish? For me, yes. But at the moment, Worcester are doing that little bit more. They're winning games, whereas Irish are coming agonisingly close, as they were against Wasps, as they were against Bath recently, and they're picking up losing bonus points. And, you've got to match your opponent stride for stride. And at the moment, Worcester are just that little bit better.
We had one last autumn test, the game that caused one or two selection problems because Premiership players weren't allowed to play in them unless they were called to Lupe Faletau, and that decision might cost Bath a couple of thousand quid. Wales against South Africa. Wales winning by a couple of points. I don't know how much of this you managed to
catch. Yeah, no,
I
did watch it. I mean, I'm always a bit miffed as to why Wales need a fourth international.
Money.
Is it because they make as much money out of four as maybe England and Scotland do out of three, or Ireland? I don't know what it is, but it's almost sort of after the Lord Mayor's show, really. Like, international rugby's over for everyone, but yet they've got one more game. Wales's autumn did not go according to plan. Ireland probably had the best autumn international series, closely followed by England, I would say.
Better than Scotland?
Yeah, I think so, in terms of the results. I mean, Scotland won a game against Australia and won a, you know, and Samoa, and won a worthy game. And
nearly drew against the All Blacks.
Ireland won 3 out of 3. England won 3 out of 3. Scotland won 2 out of 3. So I think, you know, by that standard, I'd put it as Ireland, England, Scotland.
I think Scotland had a better autumn than England. I think Scotland were more promising than England.
I think England weren't tested, really. That's the problem.
I got that look on your face then, which referees used to get when you got up from the back of a scrum and you weren't entirely happy with the decision. That quizzical look.
Scotland made the more significant improvement in terms of where they were before. Okay, I'll give you that, because I thought the game against New Zealand was magnificent. And you know, if a Stuart Hogg pass had gone, we'd be waxing lyrical about Scotland now and saying how well they played. So, and the result, by the way, against the Wallabies was probably, out of all of them, the one game that stood out amongst all of them. That was the standout result. But Wales, up until that South Africa game, had a poor autumn international series. Woeful game against Georgia. You know, I mean, I don't often struggle to watch a game of rugby, but I really struggled to watch that. You know, lost again for the 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th time against Australia. I can't remember what it is, but they lost again. And the second half against, well, the match against New Zealand actually was a really entertaining game to watch, but they still lost it. So for them, it was absolutely crucial that they got something out of this South African game. So I think it was more important for Wales than anyone else. I'm always a little bit sceptical about the autumn international series for any team, even when I played, because you should be at your best. You know, it's the start of the season in the Northern Hemisphere. We're kind of a couple of months in, and those guys are hanging on by their fingernails at the end of the season. So, you know, it's worrying that South Africa are so poor at the moment. But it's good news for Wales and Warren Gatland that they've got a win.
Let's quickly touch on England with reference to the WRU, because it was interesting to see Stephen Brown, who's the new RFU chief executive a mile or so up the road at Twickenham, talking this week about their long-term plan to replace Eddie Jones, who will go after the World Cup in 2019. And he said, while we're not as far down the road as the WRU say they are, while they don't have a shortlist of three in their mind, they're not far behind, which I thought was interesting. There's a progression plan in there. Have you heard anything?
No, I haven't. But I guess one of the big accusations, rightly, that's been levelled at England over the years in rugby particularly, is succession planning. You know, it's been very, very poor. The post-Clive Woodward era had no real kind of strategy around who to appoint. You know, we went from Andy Robinson, Brian Ashton, Martin Johnson, Stuart Lancaster. There didn't seem to be a process or a methodology that was followed. It can often be uncomfortable to talk about who's going to replace someone as coach in the very public domain. But in this case, it's not uncomfortable because Eddie Jones has very clearly
set the agenda.
I've set the agenda. Yep. Win or lose the Rugby World Cup in Japan, that will be my last game for England. Doesn't mean he won't take another job somewhere else, but he won't be with England. And when I interviewed him, and you've interviewed him a couple of times, he outstayed his welcome in Australia. He stayed too long. He stayed there for 6 years. It cost him his job. So I think he's learned that lesson, not to do that again. Yeah. So he's going. And I think England and Steve Brown are very comfortable discussing that. What they haven't done is put forward any names.
Right, let's do that. So can we work on the assumption that as well as Paul Gustard and Steve Borthwick and Neil Hatley are doing, you might think that they would have to go out and get a DOR's job back in the Premiership before they came back in to take charge of a test team?
Well, I think England would be... I'd be very surprised if they gave the job to put someone who hasn't done it before. In other words, they've been down that road three or four times, yeah. and it's backfired on them. What they did with Eddie Jones is find someone who has got pedigree at the very highest level. He coached the Rugby World Cup team in Australia in 03, narrowly losing to England. He was assistant coach in South Africa, and then he went on to Japan and masterminded the biggest upset in sporting history.
Yeah.
So that was no surprise that when he introduced himself as England coach, he's actually won every game bar one. So I don't think they're going to go back to someone who's never done the job before. So if we assume that, in terms of one at the highest level, I think that their candidates will include, not super coaches, but coaches who have already coached international rugby.
Oh, really?
I think so, yeah.
So that rules out Rob Baxter?
No, it doesn't. No, I'm not saying that's the only candidates, but I think it will.
Now, hang on. We're coming up with three names. We can't have a shortlist of 30.
No, we can have three. I mean, Rob Baxter will very much be in that shortlist.
Okay.
I felt that he should have been included a little bit more in England's plans alongside Eddie Jones, but that was kind of, pushed to one side or given the firm handoff by a lot of other people who thought that, why would you not continue to coach rather than be an assistant coach? And, there's very good merit in that. But I still think there's a number of other international coaches that would be interested in the job, like Joe Schmidt, if he's not committed to Ireland, the usual suspects that keep get banded around. I think what's clear with the appointment of Eddie Jones is that it doesn't have to be an English coach.
No. What about a Welshman? What about Di Young?
Yeah, absolutely. There's no reason why he couldn't be considered. He's not
Mark McCall. What about an Irishman?
Mark McCall. Yeah, he's not put himself forward for the Welsh job. So
we can only assume that he is on that shortlist of three. The WRU haven't told us who's on the list, but it would be an odd list given the chat if David Young's name wasn't on that.
Yeah,
shortlist.
It is. Although he's maybe. At a point in his career where he's made it clear that he doesn't want to be on that list. Who knows? I think England's list, long list, because they're not as far down the road as Wales, so they're not down to three yet. I think their long list will be about six, and I think three of those six will be either current international coaches, and the other three will probably consist of coaches who are playing and plying their trade in England. And I would say that those three names you've mentioned are very much top and front of mind. Rob Baxter, Mark McCall. Not just because they operate, they occupy the teams at the very top of the table, but that tends to be the way it goes. You don't tend to look at teams down the bottom of the table.
Okay. I'm tempted not to ask you this question because you'll give me one of those lol frowns again. But if we were to put this podcast in a tin and bury it for 2 years and then dig it up, could you give me a name now? Who do you think it will be?
Well, I'd like to see Rob Baxter coaching.
Would you?
Yeah,
would you?
Okay. Absolutely. 100%. I would have been, if he'd have been given the job a year ago, I'd have been happy with that. Or 2 years ago. Yeah. Definitely. Because I'd seen and heard enough of what he says that I liked. Not that what I like matters, but, do you know what I mean? It's the players speak very highly, and he's already shown how he's able to build a team. But he would probably argue, and I think I would argue in his favour, that it would have been too soon to give him that job because he's really enjoying what he's doing at the moment. And He's got a couple of trophies in the cabinet, and hopefully he wants to add to that before he eventually takes the title of looking elsewhere.
Brilliant. Shall we talk about Europe? Pool one. Let's just do this simply. We're going to go from one to six, and we're going to rattle through this because we've been droning on for far too long about other stuff. Big games live on BT Sport this weekend, of course. So much to have a chat about. La Rochelle against Wasps. What do we make of that?
Well, La Rochelle are the form team. They are a revelation in last year and again this year. They've looked fairly awesome in two matches. So Wasps go into this kind of double header rounds three and four. This is when your European challenge is either alive or will be derailed over these next 2 weeks. Not necessarily in the first game, but certainly by the end of the second game, you'll know exactly where you stand. La Rochelle are absolute firm favourites to win at home. It's a bit of a fortress there, although Gloucester managed to find the key to unlock the door last season. But the good news for Wasps fans is that they go into this game probably playing their best rugby of the season so far. So really looking forward to that. I would expect Wasps to put up a fight, La Rochelle to win that game, and then Wasps to to repeat the favour the following week.
And the other game in that pool, in Pool 1, both games on Sunday, by the way, is one of our games, BT Sport 2, Quinns against Ulster at 12:30, Sunday lunchtime. If Ulster can start to pick up away wins, that they might sneak through, but yeah, you big, feel they're going to have to win on Sunday.
Well, it's a big if, isn't it, Nick? Because they look very strong at home, but they look very beatable away from home. And, you know, Quinns, it's interesting to see how they'll react after that wonderful performance against the European champions. They've just come off the back of beating Saracens, and, you know, can they back it up? And that will be the message from John Kingston and James Horwell.
But in Europe, played two, lost two.
Yeah,
so they've got no second chances.
Yeah, and there's no second chances. So they've just got to go out there and put their strongest possible side out and see what happens. You know, don't forget Wasps managed to qualify after losing their first two games a couple of years ago. So they'll take heart from that and think, if we can start, then start as we mean to go on.
Once we're done with Quinns Ulster on Sunday lunchtime, Sunday afternoon, mid-afternoon, Saracens against Claremont. Are you doing this one? Where are you?
No. I'm back in the studio, keeping warm,
eating biscuits. BT Sport 2, 3:00. A repeat of last year's final, obviously.
Yeah, it is a repeat of last year's final, but both sides go into this titanic, gargantuan contest, slightly, you know, in slightly foreign territory. Saracens are, as you say, on the back of five consecutive defeats. And Claremont, for all their, you know, their sort of annual sort of celebrations of European rugby, I think they're lying about seventh or eighth in their own domestic competition. So they're not in great shape. So it's going to be really, really interesting. And we said we'd expect a reaction from Saracens last weekend. I think at home at Allianz Park, you know, they need to get back to winning ways, so I can see them winning that one.
And Ospreys and Saints, I guess, with their own domestic issues, will see Champions Cup as a bit of a distraction. But the reality is they're kind of leaving it to the other two.
I think what they'll see is a chance to be out of the limelight. And I think both sets of coaches and both sets of players will probably enjoy being out of the limelight, given their current woes.
I'm not sure what your plans are for Sunday, but essentially we've got you fixed from Sunday lunchtime through to Sunday evening, because at 5:15, BT Sport 2, we've got Exeter Leinster in Pool 3. Following week, Exeter going to Dublin, of course. So many potential games of the weekend, but this is one of them as well.
Well, this one is the one that stands out for me, because of the quality of both sides, the pedigree, the form, if you like, of both sides. Exeter just flying high at the moment, particularly at Sandy Park. And I expect them to be favourites. I think they've got that confidence that they can now actually do something in Europe. They've always flattered to deceive. Their focus has always been on the Premiership, Exeter. But now I think they believe that they can do something. They've set themselves up with the opening two games. And the big question will be, can Leinster get anything out of this fixture, even a losing bonus
game? Yeah, and that might be critical, actually, because they both play 2-1-2 so far, but Leinster have picked up bonus points, so they're 2 points ahead of the Chiefs at the moment in the table.
Yeah, and Exeter will be very mindful of that. They'll be targeting a win, and they'll be trying to ensure that Leinster don't get anything from that game. So, you know, really, really excited about that. And the lovely thing about these fixtures is you've only got to wait one more week to see it all over again.
Yep. Off to Limerick myself on Saturday for Munster against Leicester. I love Thomond Park. I love the old Thomond Park, the old wooden place where you got splinters in your bum. But they've built this new steel stadium, and it still hums. It still vibrates with emotion, isn't it? There are no better places to watch club rugby in Europe than Thomond Park, in my mind.
It's wonderful. It's a cathedral. It's just a wonderful place. You know, the passion that the whole of Munster has for their team, for their community, for the game of rugby is wonderful. And this is a repeat of a fixture last year, and Leicester will be having nightmares about this. They were 38-0. I think it's hard not to score a point in rugby. You know, Leicester managed it comfortably against Munster. Munster playing, of course, with the emotion behind the tragic passing of Anthony Foley, which they don't have now necessarily. They've got to find the same levels of emotion to deal with that fixture. So really looking forward to that. As I said, I'm joining you there, and should be an exciting game. A few injury concerns for both sides, but, you know, Munster will see this and target this as a game that they have to win.
Well, let's have a listen to Peter O'Mahony. He's had a word with Craig this week. Craig's going to be part of the team at Toman Park on Saturday, and this is what the Munster skipper has had to say to him this week.
Well, Pete, I guess it feels a bit like Christmas around here. The week building up to the back-to-back European games in December, a real celebration down in Munster when a big team like Leicester Tigers comes over. Are you excited?
Yeah, you know, European rugby is the games you want to be involved in here, and it's no different. As you said, it's even more special actually when these little mini competition within the pool comes. You know, the back-to-back games and. You know, a team like Leicester, their history and their quality, you know, it's always a cracker between us, and you know, you'd be expecting the same at the weekend.
What's it like out in the streets around Munster and Limerick and Cork? And what's the buzz about this fixture?
I think they love being in, you know, going to the European games and you know, the atmosphere obviously in Toman Park this weekend, it's always special, and you know, there's always a big build up to it during the week, especially obviously in Limerick. But you know, even when I'm back home in Cork, Wednesday evening, Thursday, you know, you're around town, you know, you'd be getting fellas fired up over it and giving their opinions and all sorts, and you know straight away it's European Cup week around the place.
When they came and beat you here though in 2015, first time you were beaten in your own patch in Europe in a decade, was it?
So yeah.
How much did that hurt, and how much was last season's win over them, an absolute thrashing of them, a reaction to that?
I think rugby's got away from looking back. I know it's, you know, you want to win all the time at home. You want to win every game. Every team that goes out wants to win every game, but, you know, your ones at home are certainly special, especially with us in Europe. You know, we've a good record there and we try and protect it, but, you know, it's a different game every week and it's a different opposition, and, you know, this is the one team that have come and won twice in Toman Park. So, you know, as I said, that they're not going to be worried about it. They've been there and done it, most of them. So, you know, we'll have to get the video work done early, but we've got to get ourselves up for a massive game. We've got to be as good as we can be, you know, to beat a team of that quality.
A lot of people talk about 0-2, and they talk about Neil back and that stray hand around the side of that scrum and the bit of naughtiness, and they dwell on that. The fans certainly dwell on that. Do you remember that game?
Yeah, sure. It broke our hearts, didn't he? But like, if he was on your team, you'd be clattering across the head delighted with him. So, you know, there's two sides to every story.
What's the dressing room like before a European game? What's it going to be like in Thomond Park Saturday night, just before you run out in that pitch?
Yeah, look, it's a great place to be. There's a huge amount of energy. Guys are bouncing, ready to go. You know, European rugby back at home. That's the reason you play the game, you know, is to play in you know, the highest quality, highest standard games, highest quality of opposition. You know, back in Toman Park, guys will be raring for a road.
And just finally, you know, we talk about the Heineken Cups. It's a Champions Cup now. You know, no matter what it's called, how the competition has changed, no matter what number you're putting in your remote control, there's something about Munster against Leicester Tigers that just gets the all blood pumping. What is it?
I think it starts off, obviously, with the respect that we have for each other. As I spoke about the history, obviously, that we both have with the competition, but, you know, it would be very similar, I would imagine, over there now this week. They'd be pepping their step, and back into Europe, it's obviously very important to them. And, you know, when two teams have that kind of history and determination to win a competition like this, you know, it's always a good recipe for a big game and some big performances. And, you know, that's obviously why people watch.
A bit of speculation about where Peter O'Mahony might be playing his rugby next season, Lol. We're not sure whether he's kind of holding out for a better contract from the IRFU, or whether genuinely 2 years out from a World Cup, you are thinking about moving abroad.
I would say that, you know, Peter Manny will be staying in Ireland for the foreseeable future. It'd be crazy to leave, you know, mid World Cup sort of cycle. But in saying that, you know, you get your head turned when you get offered a lot of money by other clubs. And I think he probably wants the IRU to split the difference between what they're offering him now and what a couple of other clubs might be offering him in the future. And if they do that, then, you know, he is the glue that holds the whole of Munster together. He's been absolutely outstanding for the last 12 months for Munster, for Ireland, and for the Lions, let's not forget. So he'll be right in the thick of the action come Sunday.
Tight pull that, actually. Leicester, Munster, Racing and Cast, all within striking distance. Leicester and Munster with 6 points, Racing and Cast not far behind. Racing have got 5, Cast have got 3. They're 4 teams who can still bruise each other. There's a long way to go in this.
There is a long way to go. Very, very close. And I think that's probably why rounds 3 and 4 are so crucial, because someone can actually take ownership of the group. It's still very much all to play for. And in many ways, that means that the way that these first games play out might have a long way towards the selections and the way that those sides approach the next one. So really, really crucial games. But as you say, all to play for across the board.
2 games in Pool 5 on Saturday. The big one, I guess, from our point of view is Bath with that away trip to Toulon. Scarlets against Benetton is the other game at Parker Scarlets. Both games on the Saturday. Bath with a little bit to do to get something from Toulon, but if they can, with the state of the pool as it is at the moment, both of those sides locked on 8 points.
Yeah, I mean, these are the two sides that stand out. I mean, I felt, along with a few others, that Scarlets might be challenging a bit better. They sort of disappointed, really, in Europe. I was expecting a stronger challenge from them. Maybe they're saving their best rugby for the domestic competition, but certainly Bath and Toulon certainly got history with this competition, haven't they? I mean, for Bath, it's all about getting something in that away fixture. I don't think they're quite at the strength where they can necessarily go out there and be firm favourites to win the game. But if they can take something away and keep the group alive so that they come back to the wreck, because as we know, Toulon, for all their strength, for all their power, for all their history, they're poor on the road. So Bath will fancy their chances of getting something.
And Scarlets, having done so well domestically in recent times in the Pro 14, it's just finding it hard to transfer from one to the other at the moment. You either have to concentrate on A or B, it seems, right?
Yeah,
now.
I mean, maybe it's squad strength, squad depth. You know, the Welsh regions, for whatever reason, have struggled to compete both domestically and in Europe at the same time. You know, that none of the Welsh sort of super regions have managed to make their statement in Europe. And you just get the sense with Scarlets that the quality is there. They were unbelievable last season, but they're making one or two quite astute signings, so they're building for the future. And it won't be long before the Scarlets are able to sort of compete with some of the kind of superpowers of European rugby. But I'm afraid for Scarlets fans, I don't think that's going to be this season.
We've got a busy weekend. So where are you? What are your travel
plans? I'm in Munster on Saturday.
Yep.
And then I'm with Craig and Brian.
In the studio.
In the studio. We're across the 3 games that are taking place on Sunday, and then we are delivering the highlight show at the very end of that. So a huge amount of European rugby to get through.
Oh, and we've got a BT Fun Bus going from Limerick to Dublin. Are you on that?
I'm on the Fun Bus.
You're in charge of Jammy Dodgers.
I'm in charge of Jammy Dodgers.
Excellent.
And refreshments.
Good weekends, these, aren't they?
They are.
For great fans and...
I mean, there was a notch of excitement. When I used to play, which was a long time ago, you used to walk into training and you knew it was a European weekend because there was a real big spring in your step. You also had to check where your passport was as well, just in case. And it's the same...
Well, you know, I came across mine today. I didn't realise it was where I found it. I'd have been having a right old panic on Friday otherwise.
It's the same for BT Sport. You know, there's a little bit of a spring in the step. Not that we don't love and adore the Aviva Premiership.
Nope.
We do.
Nope.
But... you know, this is international rugby in a club jersey.
I think we're nearly done, Chairman, aren't we? In the boardroom here. AOB, any other business? Or is it time to... you don't know the pubs in this area very well, so I might have to show you one or two myself.
There's the Sun Inn, the Triple Crown.
Yeah,
there's one or two that could lead us astray.
We've got one or two more things to talk about. But I think that's it in terms of the podcast. Thank you very much for listening. We are back next week, of course. Benny and Dricko are in the studio. Ellis Genge, who's got a bit of time on his hands now, poor lad, is joining them. So that'll be interesting. And if you want to watch all the games, the highlights of this weekend, then make sure that you tune into our Champions Cup highlight show 7:30 on BT Sport 2 this Sunday. You do that. So that's actually a double shift for you on Sunday, isn't it?
It is.
It's biscuits, but you do work hard.
We might have breakfast, lunch and dinner in the studio.
Size of a house. Lord Dallaglio of London Town needing an extra large coach to get him back to his castle. Remember, subscribe to this pod so it's delivered straight to your device every Thursday. And if you have enjoyed listening today, then if you can, give us a 5-star rating and a nice review on iTunes. Thanks, Lowell. Say goodbye.
Bye for now.
Bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc. Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.